This episode of Continuing Mission is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your smartphone, tablet, or desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Continuing Mission, our look at the ways in which fans are keeping Star Trek alive. I'm your host, Christopher Jones, and the primary focus of this show is on the fan series and independent productions that tell new stories set in the Star Trek universe. The original series, or at least the late 23rd century, tends to be the focal point of today's fan productions, but that doesn't mean Kirk and Spock must always take the lead. There was a gap between the end of the five-year mission and the refit of the Enterprise as we saw it in the motion picture. What happened during that time? Star Trek's Secret Voyage, a creation of Craig Sheeler, is the story of a special mission carried out aboard the historic 1701 during that time, but under the command of a different captain with a different crew. Today, I'm joined by Craig to learn more about the series, various aspects of production, and the premise behind the first two episodes. Hello, Craig. Welcome to Continuing Mission. It's great to have you back on the network. I looked it up and it has been more than 2 years since you joined me to talk about Secret Voyage the first time. How are you doing?
Great. Good. Yeah, it's good to be here, Christopher.
So your second episode is out and I'm looking forward to hearing about that today. But for many listeners, this may be the first time that they've heard you talk about Secret Voyage and maybe the first time that they're not familiar with you personally. And so what I like to do on this show is learn a little bit about the fandom background of those who make these independent productions, because you have to truly love Star Trek to put this much time and energy and money into something. So do you remember the first Star Trek episode you saw, your first encounter with Star Trek?
Yeah, I remember watching it as a child with my father, and my parents were very much into, they watched Star Trek regularly, and I remember the first images I saw of it were the episode where Charlie X takes away the face of the Enterprise personnel gal. I thought that was really wild, and just scenes like that, the scenes of them beaming down, the scenes of the rubber animals that attach themselves to their backs look like a fake, you know, throw up.
And yeah, I always thought they looked like space fried eggs as well.
Right. You know, yeah, space fried eggs. So I watched that from time to time. I probably connected more with shows like Lost in Space and stuff like that that were more geared towards kids, but there was just this attraction to Star Trek. And then I remember my parents going to a Halloween costume and dressing up as Star Trek. My dad dressed up as Spock and my mother dressed up as with a beehive hairdo and original costumes that they had made. And I always thought that was very impressive that they could pull that off. And so that kind of probably locked away in my mind and then, just became more of an avid watcher of Star Trek. After that, I remember my uncle asking me if I was as a Trekkie, and I didn't even know what he was talking about. And then when I, after Next Gen came out and I saw him again, I said, yes, I am a Trekkie or Trekker as many would say. So it took
a
while.
Do you have
a
preference, Trekkie, Trekker? Does it matter to you?
No, it doesn't matter to me.
Yeah. It doesn't matter to me either.
It's all geek speak, you know?
So when did you first think, I want to create a story like this myself? Does that go back to a young age for you, like it does with a lot of people who do fan films, or is it something more recent?
No, I think, well, back in right after high school, in the early 80s, I went to go visit some friends up in Spokane, Washington, and they like to make movies. And so we would come up with ideas for movies. And so they wanted to do a film when we got up there for a comic convention that they were having locally. And they had done a commercial for it the year before. And so they had already lined it up. They had cameras. They had all this. They had a script. And when we got up there, they canceled the comic convention because they were going to close down the Davenport Hotel at the time.
Oh, really?
So, so we'd already bought our plane tickets. So we got up there. It's like, well, what do we do? So we just quickly wrote a Star Trek movie. They had the costumes and all that. And it was Star Trek. It was the crew of the Enterprise beams down to a planet and encounters Darth Vader. and matter of fact, that episode is actually on YouTube. You have to look for it.
Oh, is it really? Okay, I have to watch that.
It's done in like 82, 81, cool. 82.
Yeah,
and it's the Enterprise crew, and I'm a very young Chekhov at the time.
Okay,
and so, but yeah, we had our own original villain, but then we had this wonderful Darth Vader costume available, so of course we had to throw that in there too. So that was my first Star Trek movie.
Cool, very cool. Well, today you're actually producing Secret Voyage, and for those again who aren't familiar with it yet. Give us a quick overview of the premise of Secret Voyage, because you use a familiar ship, but you have a different crew.
Right. I think everybody wants to be the captain of the Enterprise. I think, you know, they would love to be Captain Kirk, but not everybody can be Captain Kirk. So I thought, you know, when you take the chance of coming up with a new crew and a new ship and new adventures, there's a little disconnect because people resonate so much with the familiarity of the right. Enterprise, just the name Enterprise. Yeah. And so I didn't want to do a story where we were trying to portray the original cast. And I mm-hmm. know I didn't really have an idea of trying to create a brand new ship. I really just wanted to do a story that was all about going on a planet and what happened on the planet. I didn't have a budget and a sets to do all that. And I thought, you know, those to me were always very interesting shows when they went to these different worlds. And so I was reading a bunch of Star Trek novels to get ideas, and I came across this novel by Dillard called The Lost Years. And right. in that, it was the story of how the Enterprise comes back after its 5-year mission. Scotty goes off to take some R&R and then start to develop the plans for the refit. And the rest of the cast go off on some adventures. And it occurred to me if that was to be somewhat of an explanation of canon, then during that 6 months of shore leave and all that, well, that Enterprise is just sitting there waiting to be torn down for the refit. It would be perfectly acceptable to be able to borrow it or use it for a covert mission of some mm-hmm. kind, right. Because, you know, it wouldn't be expected to be any place other than maybe, you know, in a deck hangar or something like that, space hangar. Right. So that's where the idea came to. I could take an original crew that just is put together for one secret mission. And so that was our premise.
Great. It's interesting you mentioned you wanted to do something on a planet, because as I watch the stuff, I can see that you do love the away missions, I feel. And you mentioned a moment ago that you connected with Lost in Space when you were a kid. And I also watched that when I was a kid. And so much of that takes place outside of the Jupiter ship and on the planet surface as well.
Yeah, I think that, and the area we live in the southern Nevada, we have some unique areas. We have a lot of great desert terrain. We have the lake. We don't have to travel that far, and we have forest trees.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, you know, coming up with some unique landscapes was going to be pretty good for at least a few episodes. And the fact that we're not that far from LA, so. I've even been out just the last month or so. I was down at Velasquez Rock doing some exploring and cataloging and
oh, really?
Taking some shots and measurements. Yeah. And you know, they may see something like that.
Great. Well, give us an overview. We're going to talk primarily today about your new episode, Rise of the Gongadae, your second episode. But give us an overview of the first episode, Whose Birth These Triumphs, before we get into that.
Okay, yes, because this new one actually takes place where that one left off. So the basic premise is that an admiral calls together a team to check out some trading on a planet called Altruon that exists just beyond the galactic barrier. So this is a race that the Starfleet has no real record of. They have no connections with, but they discovered this new call it an energy or power source on a ship, derelict ship that had been over on that far side of the galaxy, and they had record of this planet and where they had gotten this. So the Admiral thinks this is a great way to maybe move up in rank, maybe sway some votes in the Senate to go his way. And what it really is it's a substitute for quanta lithium, not really a power source, but a substitute for quanta lithium that has a way of a purer way of dealing with the warp drives and all of that. And so they're able to get more speed, more stability out of their warp drive capabilities with this substance that they have called quanta lithium, but the inhabitants of the planet call it kainite. And okay. So the basic premise is that, you know, go to this other planet, negotiate with this race of beings and see if how much of this quanta lithium you can bring back, because, you know, imagine what that would do to our ships, giving them more power. We could cross the galaxy better. It would put us way above the Klingons and the Romulans. So go for it. You got your team. You got 6 months to get back here with a signed treaty.
And since the first episode is where we meet the crew for the first time, tell us a little bit about the actual crew of the ship. We'll talk about the casting a little bit later, but in terms of the captain who's on the ship, who's going on this mission.
Okay. Yes, we've got a captain who basically prior to this mission was a first officer. Mm-hmm. So this is a chance to captain for the first time, Captain Calvin Mercer. And his father actually was in Starfleet and taught at the Academy. And his first officer that he chooses is an Andorian female that he actually spent a lot of time with growing up, because both of their fathers served together. So her father was actually the captain and his father was the second officer of the last command. So this is sort of a trade of places. Mm-hmm. So whereas his father was her first officer and now it's vice versa, she's his first officer. And so they know each other really well. And she sort of looks at him as like a brother, but she also is able to maintain that professionalism and that rank. And she's a very by the book Starfleet officer. Mm-hmm.
Did you have a great desire as a TOS fan to have an Andorian character so that you could do the makeup and play around in that world?
I knew I wanted strong female characters in this. I wanted a strong female character on Dorian, and I wanted a strong female character, a Vulcan type, because I thought it would be very interesting to have them interacting a little bit. And then them also in different roles than they might have normally played, not having a Vulcan be a science officer or anything like that. Right. So initially, I knew I wanted to have very strong females, so we immediately cast that. We have a very strong xenobiologist that comes along on the mission. So she sort of plays that role of the doctor, not the medical doctor, but one that understands races, understands their phobias, and understands how to maybe make communications. So she's sort of a cross between an Uhura type as far as linguistics, but also the biology and the psychology of alien races.
And who else is on the crew besides these characters?
So then we have a very old friend of the captain's family, is a Lieutenant Ben Jones. Now, Ben Jones, he appears in the very first part of the first episode talking with the Admiral, and they are talking about, obviously, some mistakes that he's made along the way in Starfleet, where he looks like he lost his commission. There's some hard feelings, I think, between the families, between Ben Jones and Mercer's father, for something that happened on the ship that they served on. And so now this is a chance for Ben to redeem himself by fulfilling the Admiral's plans. And so he's sort of a ace in the hole. He's like, he's told Mercer, you're going to do this mission. You're going to bring back this quanta lithium. But then he's also told Jones, you are going to make sure this happens. You're going to be the ace in the hole. You're going to make sure that whatever it takes, even if you've got to cheat a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so he becomes sort of the loose card.
Okay. So the first episode you've described, and you said the second episode picks up from that one. It moves us forward in the story. So you recently completed the second episode. It's now available. People can watch it online. And we're caught in a civil war. Captain Mercer finds himself caught in a civil war here. Very TOS type storyline. Tell us a bit about this episode.
Yes. of course, as I said, it takes up where the other one had left off, which is when they get to the planet, they find out that this race of beings has no interest in negotiating, and they don't even want to deal with the humans. And they find out that they've got their own problems, which is there's actually two races on this planet. There's a race of very very devout, almost very religious in nature, very stoic group of people that are called the Gimtau, and then a very barbaric race that is kept as slaves on the planet that are called the Gongdai. And so by the end of the first episode, you see a clear division between these two races, and they sort of get caught in the middle of it because they're sort of in the wrong place at the wrong time, at just at the time that this that the Gongdai have decided that they're going to rise up against their oppressors and take the Kainite or Quantalithium for themselves.
When you approach this story, it feels like there's sort of a divide, I think, with fandom when we think about Star Trek, because we're accustomed very much to TNG, DS9, Voyager, Enterprise, Star Trek, where there's a lot more dialogue. It's not as action-driven as even some of TOS is, but your approach seems to be a bit more action-oriented. We talked about how you like to use the landscapes. You're out there on the planet's surface there. How do you approach your storytelling with all of your episodes, but this one is in particular? And what's your inspiration for that? What are you pulling from? Is it exclusively Star Trek? Are you putting your own twist on it the way that maybe you wanted to see Star Trek told?
I think the twist is that besides the fact that we're trying to produce a much darker theme and a darker storyline in some of the things that some of the visuals that we're exploring. But beyond that, I feel like the 1960s version of Star Trek had a very limited budget by its standards, and the special effects, you know, were all practical at the time, as much as they could be, besides phasers and things like that. And so I always wanted to see what it would look like if they had a lot of fast-paced action. You would see a couple of episodes of Deep Space Nine and even Voyager where there was a lot of stuff happening, you know, where most of the action we saw were ships blasting each other in space, but on the planet having a couple of shootouts maybe. But I had some ideas in mind that I wanted to see a lot more stunt work, and I wanted to have a lot more of interaction between phaser fire, even from the sky, from other ships. I just wanted I wanted a heat of the moment, a lot of action on the ground that got really busy. And I find that some of the more interesting scenes from some of the directors that I've watched, it's the humor or the drama or the story. There's little nuances that are picked up in a busy scene. For instance, Steven Spielberg, if you take a look at any scene that he's got where it might be two people talking, there's so much going on in one of those scenes that you almost got to watch it a couple times to see the layers of things that are happening. And so, but put that into a scene that's already an action scene, and just trying to have little things happening in the background or more than one thing happening at a time. And so I was trying to take that approach, even though, you know, I wouldn't say we had much of a budget either, but we attempted at least to have as much action as we could squeeze into the minutes of an episode that we had.
Shooting one of these scenes, these action scenes there in the desert, for example, like we see at the beginning of Rise of Gongdai, how long does it take you to shoot one of those? Do you try to get it all in one day? Do you have specific time frames where you can shoot because of the heat, for example, and of course the lighting as well?
Yeah, Nevada deserts can be very unpredictable. So when we weren't inundated with windy days or the heat, or in the winter it actually does get quite cold, on most days it was just plain hot. You know, that was pretty much the standard day. And double knit polyester Starfleet uniforms do not breathe well,
right?
But they also don't show a lot of sweat stains, which is nice. So we had that going for us. But we would typically set out. We would do a shot list, and for every page of script, it would take us about an hour to shoot. So, you know, in an 8 to 10 hour day, which we would try to accomplish, we would shoot a good 8 to 10 pages unless we had some stunt work, because a stunt scene would take an extra hour just for that scene to work out the details and stuff. And our captain lead, Tyrone Lucas, he's also a stuntman, so he was able to choreograph a lot of the scenes that were necessary.
How are you approaching it in terms of equipment and, you know, number of cameras and how many people are out there with you for audio visual, for sound? How are you handling all that on a very limited budget?
It was hands on, all hands on. We had an external recorder, boom microphone. We had two cameras on the set at all times, but we typically went with a single camera format. That way we could shoot all from one side, shoot the other side. We had to sacrifice a little on the lighting, but we were doing all natural lighting, so we didn't have to worry too much about that. But a typical crew for us, we had somebody who would help us out with some continuity issues and the script issues. We would have makeup artists on scene. We would have our one or two audio people, and then I did most of the camera work myself. So we only had a camera crew of maybe a background crew of maybe four. Okay. On any day. Mm-hmm. But we weren't shooting more than maybe four people at a time on any given day. There was only one day where it was everybody all at once. And we were able to find this wonderful location just outside of Good Springs, Nevada, that looked like an abandoned, destroyed temple. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, it was used for mining of some kind. And so we had the entire cast there for that for an entire day. And it was very hot, and it was a blast though for that particular day. It was great location, great scenery, and but that was our probably our biggest filming day.
Mm. This episode also has a lot of scenes of the shuttle, the Galileo shuttle, flying around on the ground as well. I wanted to ask you a bit about visual effects because, again, you're working on a very limited budget with this, and you're dealing with the original series. And trying to capture the feel of the original series as well, as I can see. There are also scenes of the Enterprise in space, especially in your opening credits, for example. Right. You have that, and you have some of the Enterprise in a dry dock as well. How do you go about your visual effects? Who's creating those, and what's the process there?
Well, in the first episode, I reached out to as many people as I possibly could, and I had all of our Enterprise shots were for the first episode, and the orbital shots that we did pickups for in the second episode, mm-hmm. were all done by NeoFX. Michael Shuker there, he did a great job of putting those together for us. Then we had some other complicated scenes from the first episode. We had a little help from a guy named Kenneth Thompson. But a lot of the other stuff, I pretty much had to figure it out on my own. Okay. It's really hard when you have no money and your talent pool is pretty small. You get people who want to be involved in the project, but as soon as they have to start putting a lot of time in, their interests fade off because they don't see the big picture.
Right.
So we would have a lot of people who would step up and agree to do stuff and then fade off and not meet the deadline or whatever. And we would be stuck holding the bag, so to speak. Yeah. Well, I've got this complicated scene I've got to do, and who's going to do it? Guess it's going to be me. So, I managed to get a hold of some good models, 3D models, and just working with the 3D programs was able to, you know, force out of it what I could to try to create the visuals that we needed.
You know, a lot of people I talk to who do these films, they learn new crafts and new trades that they didn't know before in order to make the films themselves. Is 3D modeling or working with the 3D models and the software something that you've learned over the years? Is it something that you learned just specifically so that you could make these scenes?
I learned specifically to do these scenes. I'm a graphic artist by trait, so my background is in print media.
Yeah, same for me.
Yeah. Photography, that kind of stuff. So visual media, you know, filming, I can frame a camera pretty well. Mm-hmm. But a lot of things I've had to learn, you know, the 180 rule, the eyeline rule, a lot of that has been a learn as I go. Yeah. And the wonderful thing about working with people who have worked on other productions, is they could teach you a little bit. And I had a very patient cast and crew that, you know, they knew that I was a novice when I started. They saw that this project was turning out to be bigger than I had originally intended.
Mm-hmm.
And we just went with it. You know, the storyline and everything just turned out to become bigger than we had first anticipated, but they stuck through it. There were some days they sat there in costume a whole day and never got in front of the camera. But we learned to shave off time and some of those issues. But when it came to the 3D animation, I just slowly started, you know, figuring out how to do it. I did have to hire a guy to take my shuttle model and build in the articulations so that the landing gear could come up and down when I needed it to.
Okay.
So then I had to figure out how to trigger that and then figure out, you know, putting a stars background and some of that stuff, but interacting it with scenes and using stabilizers and camera mapping, that all was pretty new to me, but it got to be a lot of fun when you could take a scene and camera map it and then attach your stuff to it and improve the craft in each scene. I think we had, you know, close to 200 special effects scenes for each episode that had to be done. Just little stuff.
Mm-hmm. Maybe the viewer doesn't even notice is a special effects scene, right?
Getting rid of cleaning up stuff out in the terrain or maybe just our Andorian. Every scene that she's in, I have to color correct her lips. Because there wasn't a good makeup that just kept covering up her lips, and every time she'd talk, it would come off. So, so literally, I had to track her mouth in every shot and created it so that even when she opens her mouth, it's blue inside. So those are just little fun stuff that we got to do.
Eat some blueberries before you shoot.
Yeah, or a blue popsicle. Sure, that would have been right. Yeah. Tutti Frutti is our solution.
Well, I know what you mean. I mean, you and I have a very similar background, which I'm also a designer, and I worked in print for so many years, and so I've had to learn to do a lot of things as well. But 3D is something that I've never really been able to get my mind around, so that's impressive that you're able to learn it to that extent to be able to do this.
And matter of fact, we recently had somebody convert our shuttle 3D model into After Effects, so that will help us to be able to integrate into future scenes because it can work in 3D space.
Yeah, that's cool. Another thing I wanted to ask you about is music. And I feel there are some very familiar sounds from the original series in here, sounds and roars, for example. And also the music takes cues from the original series music, and then it goes in its own directions as well. Who's putting together the music for you? Who's doing the sound effects? Is that all you as well?
Well, we were very fortunate to be contacted when we first started the production from a composer named Michael Kubertanz from Germany.
Mm-hmm.
He actually teaches at Stuttgart University. And somehow, when we first started reaching out to people, he in Germany found out about our project and emailed me. And I'm still not sure if I know exactly who told him we were in need of his services. But
well, Star Trek is big in Germany.
That's big.
Yeah, probably the second or third anyway, with the UK largest audience outside of the US. Yeah.
So he was we were very fortunate to get him, and he's incredibly talented. He actually does scores for other movies, and he loved the idea of taking it on. So we would send him the script, and he would read it, and he would determine what sounds were needed. And the approach was always use the instrumentation that was used in the original show, but throw some darker tones on there, but make it your own. Make it your own, but make it feel like it would fit right in there with the TOS era. Mm. And I think he did a really good job. And I think that the scores that he wrote for the second episode were even more improved. And matter of fact, just 2 weeks ago, we released those online so people can go listen to the soundtrack.
Oh, cool. So just the soundtrack is available. Okay.
They can look on our Facebook page and get the link. And because he's done a credible job of putting that together.
Mm-hmm.
And so... So again, he became a very strong character, the music, a lot of fan films use the original music, which is great, but you know, we did not want to stand risk of being shut down because CBS and Paramount own the rights to that music.
Right.
You know, if you nowadays, if you try to post anything on YouTube and it recognizes the music, it shuts you out immediately.
Yeah, that's YouTube. They just have automatic scanners that take you down. Yeah.
Yeah.
That happens
and
to
so,
a lot of people. Mm.
Since we actually were in talks, we actually spoke with CBS legal team in the, during our production. And so we got permission to them to produce this and we follow their guidelines. And that was one of the things that we had told them is that we, all of our visuals were all original scenes. All of our animation was going to be original. All of our music would be original. So we would not be stealing any content from the original era. Mm-hmm. And they liked that a lot.
Great, great. Well, you did a good job because there really are moments where the sounds feel like they did come from an episode. Like I hear it, I'm like, that's so familiar. What episode was that from? But yet you're creating it original, but it does feel like it's there. Like it's from the original series.
And then for like the Gongde weapons, I created that by using a lot of different sounds and layers and playing around with different stuff. So I created some of those weapons. And then some of the other stuff, we were very fortunate to have Ralph Miller, who is an incredible audio engineer who's worked on a lot of fan films and a lot of major motion pictures or not major motion pictures, but he's definitely got a lot of talent and work that he's done. And so we were able to get a hold of him, and he was able to do the final mix of our second episode.
Great.
And add those little nuances that maybe we didn't see or hear that were necessary.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Yeah, the sound makes a big difference in any production, so that's wonderful. What about casting? How did you come to bring all the different actors in to play these roles?
Well, I just basically did sort of a casting call online. And so we would probably sift through about 100 different people to where you could get a handful that didn't seem too off.
Right.
I'll put that. There's some people that were off and some that just weren't right for the parts. A lot of talented people that I would have loved to have found room for, and maybe there's room for them in other episodes, but for the main cast, finding them, and we had to go through a lot of readings, and then maybe one actor would recommend somebody that they knew that they had worked with. I mean, in the end, the team that we finally ended up with had never worked with each other before, which was interesting because
none of them had ever worked together. Because usually you find like at least two people have worked together before, right?
No, but you know, we did get them from references and stuff because we went through three Andorians before the one we finally ended up finishing with. So we'd started filming with one Andorian, and when we lost one of our cast members, she recommended a friend of hers, and so we brought the friend in, but then she had to drop out, so we had to get somebody else. So in the end, nobody had worked with each other before, but many of the people that worked on our production were all had heard about it word of mouth or were recommended by a friend. And so they contacted us and then we put together a cast from them. And I think they worked really well together. And I'd be curious to see over time what those working relationships on screen might look like.
So is everyone from the Southern Nevada area right there? Or do you have people that come in from other parts of the country for the shoots?
Right. Well, for those that haven't seen the second episode, I don't want to give away any spoilers, but what would look like our Vulcan character, she actually is from Salt Lake City. So she actually drove, you know, about 8 hours.
Wow, that's a long drive. Yeah.
It's a long drive. But other than that, everybody else pretty much worked. Although our male lead, Tyron Lucas, during the filming, because we filmed both those episodes, took about 3 years to shoot.
Mm-hmm.
There was a time period there where he lived in LA.
Okay.
And so we had to work around that schedule.
That's a lot closer than Salt Lake City, though.
It is a lot closer than Salt Lake City. But I think it was good that they had not worked together before in some senses, because, you know, the crew at times may seem kind of fragmented because they haven't worked together before. You know, when you when you watch Star Trek, you're watching a crew work together that, you know, day in and day out for a while, and they develop relationships. And the only two crew members in our cast that will have known each other would have been the first officer and the captain. So that unfamiliarity and the way that they don't always get along. But I think that by the end of the second episode, you're starting to see bonds form. And because I think that, as in life, tragedy or adventure sometimes builds friendships.
Yeah,
and you're forced to trust people that you might not normally in a daily situation do. And so it just creates those relationships.
Well, so you have two episodes under your belt. Those are out there people can watch now. What's next for Secret Voyage? Do you already have a script for the third episode? Do you have plans to shoot it?
We actually do have a pretty good script that's put together for the third episode. But when I've last spoke to the character that plays our Dr. Thomas Cage, our medical doctor in the second episode, he has a film background, and he's actually working on another science fiction film right now. And he is supposed to take over the third episode to direct and shoot that. And when I last spoke with him, we kind of talked about the original story that I have that's about 80 to 90% done, and he may want to tweak that a little bit because he's got some ideas that we want to sit down and hash out. And so it may be something that I'm not even familiar with what the next episode is going to be. I have a basic premise for about three or four more shows that I'd like to see our characters do.
Any teasers on those? Just basic premise? That may change, of course.
Yeah. Well, the premise that I would have, what we try to establish by the end of the second episode is the fact that it's now going to be the mission of this crew. Now that they've worked together, and now they're going to continue on, and there'll be stories that they go to planets, they encounter people along the way. So a typical TV type format. And so, there's some things that have to be solved. They've got to get some more supplies. They've got to seek some alliances. They've got to take care of a medical issue that's come up in the second episode. So all of those things have to be handled, and so they'll have to go to another planet to find that. And there's a particular planet out there that may not be the nicest planet. As a matter of fact, it may be where all the worst of the worst go to trade. And that is probably where they're going to go next.
Okay, interesting. Great. So no timeline at the moment on production, but you do have this outline for some upcoming episodes. So you do see Secret Voyage as living on and continuing for years to come?
That would be my hope. Of course, you know, as people need to move on in their careers, that we may have to replace people. I myself, you know, have decided after putting so much into the first two episodes that I needed to take a little bit of a step back and move to that role of executive producer / showrunner to make sure that certain continuity, certain DNA is established and continued. But beyond that, allowing them to grow and the direction that they want to go. And so I think as long as they're passionate about creating it, and as long as, there's enough fans that want to support it either socially or financially, I can definitely see them producing more episodes. I know that when I've last spoke to the cast, they're all excited about getting back in front of the camera soon.
Awesome. Well, if people want to watch the first two episodes that are out there, find out more about Secret Voyage, keep track of your future plans, and talk to you as well, where are the best places for them to go for that?
Best place that they can go, they can always go to our Facebook page. Just go to Facebook and type in Star Trek Secret Voyage. They can also go to my YouTube channel and subscribe, and they'll get any content that Secret Voyage produces. That's Sheeler Studios. And that's it for now. We had a website that we've had to do some modifications. It got hacked, so we just took it down during the interim.
Oh, okay.
And so I'm not sure. Other than just a parking spot, I'm not sure that that we're going to have a web page anytime real soon, because so much is done on the Facebook page that it seems
right.
Almost
that's
pointless.
The case for so many these days too. Social media is your contact point, and so having a dedicated page, a dedicated website is important, but it's not necessarily the primary point of contact anymore.
Yeah, so what we might do is, there may be a separate, we may create our own channel for just the Star Trek episodes rather than having it be, you know, anything that my studio produces.
Right.
It would be just the Star Trek content. Okay. I think that's sort of the way things are going. And I also feel like strongly that as most fan productions are producing, they'll either produce a vignette or they'll produce what would appear to be a 30 to 40 minute episode, which is a lot similar to what the TV content would be minus commercials, that most people, I think, at least my generation and a little younger, don't want to sit in front of a computer for an hour to watch an entire episode. And so I know some people have had success releasing it in acts, but it was always my goal that each episode would only be a 15 to 20 minute cliffhanger type of an episode.
Okay.
Sort of a serial.
Yeah.
Whether that can, the next episodes all continue to be 30, 40 minutes, or whether or not they go with that episodic 30, 40 minute piece of the action, so to speak, that launches you to the next episode, to the next episode. So I think that's a true web series format, is a good 10, 15 minutes of an episode to just build up enough action. But you know, if you're going to do that, you've got to release them more frequently. You've got to at least produce them, you know, maybe one a month or something like that, if you're going to do it like that. So I'm not sure what the format's going to be. It all depends on the story, but there's an arc now set up, a story arc that's been established, and lots of adventure that could be told. So it could go either way on that.
It's interesting because you don't see that so much on television in the States, but here in Japan, that is a format that's used where, especially in the mornings, there's a drama that is 15 minutes, but it's every day. And so by the end, you get a really long story, but it is just that bite size, 15 minutes. And it is engaging, and it does pull the viewer along. Like, I have to see the next one tomorrow. I have to see the next one.
And you can easily, you know, every four or five episodes, you can have them resolve something to where those episodes could be, you know, packaged up as an hour-long episode.
Sure.
But, you know, as fan films, we're not selling anything. So it's like, you know, I mean, I've given away quite a few DVDs, but we're not really, you know, manufacturing them and selling them. So it doesn't have to be in an hour format or a two-hour format.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Excellent. All right. So YouTube channel, your studio, Sheeler, is Sheeler, if anyone wants to check that out and watch the episodes over there. All right. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing what's next for Secret Voyage when it comes out, Craig. And thanks so much for setting aside some time for me tonight.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
Well, it was great to have Craig stop by today and talk to us about Secret Voyage. You know, going into this, I remembered talking to Craig about this project when it was first getting off the ground, or hadn't been going that long. And it's hard to believe it's been almost 2.5 years since that time. So it's great to hear they've produced two episodes, and looking forward to seeing where it goes from here. But this isn't the only thing we've been talking about on the network this past week. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
I'm just going to say this up front. I don't know if it's Koenig or Koenig. I've heard both. I'm going to go with Koenig, but if I'm wrong, just pretend I said Koenig the whole time.
And I'll go with Koenig.
All right.
And then,
so our bases and then, are covered.
So we'll both, yes. Okay. One of us will be right.
Earl Grey.
They're like, we're supposed to be decommissioned. And Kirk's like, second star to the right. And then, like, what happens after that moment? They're like, they just start like
5 minutes later. It's like, well,
I guess we do have to go
turn
back
around.
To the journey! To the journey is community. And that's what you find with Star Trek. And that's why we do what we do. And that's why we love it when you guys write us. Find us on Twitter, and that's why we're all friends on Trek.fm, is because we have this sense of community, and that's what it brings. It's not just about a show, it's about each other. Warp 5.
Mm-hmm. Archer's way is the right way. He brings the light. She walks into the light to talk to Archer, because then she is enlightened, because he is an enlightened man. Mm-hmm. She walks back into the darkness and retreats back into her world to pick up the slates and go teach the kids about the humans and the Skagarians and all that kind of stuff.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
I think it would be fun, in order to prove my point, would be like to us have us play a game of Monopoly, and also two players entirely determined by randomness. Two fictional players. It would be Mike, Max, Blue, and Green.
Continuing mission.
when we made the audio drama, it was a fairly straightforward transition. Let's call the ship the Excelsior. Let's make it the fourth one to bear the name. Let's put it in the Delta Quadrant. But now that we're there, I'm really happy with a lot of those things.
Melodic Treks.
Second marriage took place in August 6th, 1963, to Camille J. Williams, a Las Vegas dancer, and they had two children. And yes, I know, he divorced and married in the same year. I ain't gonna go anywhere near that. You draw your own conclusions.
Literary Treks.
I think I posited the idea that Lal was kidnapped, and Margaret just said in her Margaret E. way, she just said, Moriarty.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find us everywhere you get your podcasts. We're all over the place. Just search for Trek.fm or the name of the show you want to listen to, and you'll find us there. And be sure to subscribe to the Trek.fm Complete Master Feed. This is a special feed that contains every episode of every show that we do, plus some extra content that does not appear in the single show feeds. In fact, right now we have a commentary for the Star Trek 2009 film by Mike Schindler from Commentary Trek Stars, and that is only available in the master feed. So check that out. It's a great way to sample everything that we're talking about on all of our shows. If you're in iTunes or on Stitcher, be sure to leave us a review, because we still have our reviews promotion going on right now for one more week. Every review that you leave of a Trek FM show will get your name in the drawing for some great Star Trek prizes, including Blu-rays, DVDs, books, official Starships collection ships, some of our original alien art badges, and a set of three beautiful embroidered patches from Star Trek Axanar, which have been donated by Alec Peters for those who reviewed the Axanar podcast. It's very easy to enter. All you need to do is to leave a review on iTunes and or Stitcher. Those can be the individual shows or the master feed, and each review will get you an entry. Once you leave the reviews, be sure to go to trek.fm/review and submit the form that you find there. That's how you can get your name in the drawing. Again, that's trek.fm/review. And we really thank you for your reviews and look forward to hearing from you. Speaking of reviews, we do have a new review for Continuing Mission that I would like to read to you today. This is from A91R8H8 on iTunes, left us 5 stars, said, "Can't live without my Trek FM. I've been listening to some of Trek FM's podcasts since early last year. I listen to them while I'm driving on my way to and from school. I find myself so engrossed in the conversation, and I wish I was there. The people who work on this podcast are real Trekkies, Trekkers too, making the conversation all that more interesting because of their knowledge of Trek lore." So thanks so much for that review. Really appreciate that. We do try to bring as much knowledge as we can to the table when we talk about the Star Trek topics here. So I'm glad you're enjoying the shows. For everyone else, please stop by and leave us a review. It really helps us rise up in iTunes and Stitcher. It helps other fans find the shows. And that's one of the main reasons why we're really encouraging everyone right now to leave reviews, and we're giving away these great prizes. If you'd like to leave some feedback about today's show, there are many ways that you can do that. You can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose Continuing Mission, and that will come to me by email. You can also find us on Twitter. Our username is TrekFM. Facebook.com/TrekFM. We have a community on G+. We have forums at trek.fm/forums. And if you look in the left sidebar on the show pages, you'll see a widget that lets you leave us a voicemail, or you can go to speakpipe.com/TrekFM. And all you need there is the microphone on your web camera or on your smartphone or your tablet, and you can record a message and you can upload it to us right there from the page. And it'd be great to hear your voice, and maybe we can use your voicemail here on the show. If you'd like to find me personally, I'm on Twitter also. My username is C. Brian Jones, the letter C and Brian with a Y. I'm also on Facebook, facebook.com/CBrianJones. Feel free to hit me up there. And I have my website at cbrianjones.com. And elsewhere on the network, I do a lot of different shows. The Orb, Literary Treks, Warp 5, The Ready Room, Hyper Channel, which is our new show. There's also Matter Stream. And I co-host the official Star Trek Axanar podcast with Alec Peters. So as this show here is about independent productions, if you're into Axanar, make sure that you're listening to that show as well. We have great guests on there. The latest episode, we have Robert Meyer Burnett talking about editing. and just it's a great way to go behind the scenes, so definitely check that out. Before I let you go, I would like to remind you about our sponsor for today's show, Audible.com. They're the best source of audiobooks that you'll find anywhere, and I can vouch for that personally because I've been a customer for 14 years. I have hundreds of books in my library. I was listening to some last night, some other ones this morning. It's a great service that I know you'll love. And as a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice just for trying Audible. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up. Choose whatever book you want. They have great Star Trek books there, but they also have stuff from every genre you can imagine. And if at the end of the trial you decide not to stick with Audible, there's nothing to lose because you'll get to keep that audiobook. But when you support Audible, it really helps us out here at Trek FM. It helps us pay for the costs of hosting, bandwidth, distribution, production, everything that we need to get the shows out to you each week. So support us and get great books in exchange. audibletrial.com/trekfm. We really thank them for their support of the show and the network, and we thank you for supporting Audible. Well, thanks again to Craig for dropping by tonight to talk about Secret Voyage. Thank you for listening, and join me again next time here on this continuing mission, and let's see what's out there.